Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Serena Williams assessed a point penalty and a game penalty at the final of the U.S. Open. And with more, we go to John Feinstein. John, how are you?
I'm good, Jonathan. How are you guys?
Great. How about that scene on Saturday? You see anything like that before?
Well, I wasn't watching live. I was at the Navy-Memphis football game, which was a great game, by the way.
Navy came back in that game, right?
They did. They rallied from 21-9 down in the fourth quarter to win, even though the AAC did everything they could to make it difficult for Navy by scheduling the game the week after they traveled to Hawaii. So it was a tremendous win for Navy. I obviously heard about it and then watched the highlights or lowlights, depending on your viewpoint, later. And here's there's several things that need to be said about this. The first thing is the real victim in all of this was Naomi Osaka, who played brilliant tennis and soundly beat Serena Williams and deserved nothing but kudos for winning the U.S. Open and becoming the first Japanese player to win a major championship. Instead, it was all overshadowed by this. That's number one. Number two, the coaching rule should have gone away years ago. When I wrote my tennis book, Hard Courts, in 1991, 27 years ago, I wrote about this issue and about how ridiculous it was, because in the Davis Cup, the captain sits down on the court, for example, and coaches the player or players on every changeover. So what is wrong with occasional hand signals from the stands, from a coach, if you make it within the rules? Now, if players are standing there staring at their coach and not playing as a result because they're waiting for a signal, that's going too far. But to let a coach coach from the stands, why not? People get coached in every other sport, including golf, where the caddy is in many ways a coach on the golf course. That's number two. Number three, Serena was getting whipped, and that's why Mouratoglou was trying to send her hand signals, which he admitted. And so for her to react like, how dare you call me a cheat, was an overreaction. The flip side is the umpire overreacted. He should have said to her, said, Ms. Williams, okay, I've heard you, I've heard enough, let's play, rather than give her the game penalty. Now, the racket smash is automatic. There's no discretion there. That's automatic. So Serena overreacted because she was frustrated because she was getting beat, and the umpire overreacted by giving her the game penalty when he did. Now, did that happen because, as many are asserting, that, you know, he didn't like being yelled at by a woman and he was being sexist? I don't know. I don't know the guy. I don't know what was in his head. I know that a lot of women are outraged by this. But the fact is, Serena behaved poorly, he behaved poorly, and poor Naomi Osaka was the victim.
If a male tennis player was doing the same thing mm-hmm. that Serena Williams was doing, would it have the same outcome more times than not? Taking this chair umpire out of it, do you think that a man would get away with that? Even the taking signals from the coach part of it that Serena was arguing.
Well, Nadal's been called for it in the past. It's not like this has never happened, because Nadal's coached all the time. And many players are coached all the time. So it's not like this is the first time a player's been called for being coached. Now, that being said, it's very selective. And that's another problem with the rule. You know, how do you know for sure if a guy's coaching or if a guy's scratching his head? And that's a big problem with the rule. But a lot of people have brought up John McEnroe. Now, one of the few people I actually have expertise on happens to be McEnroe. And John almost never cursed on the tennis court. Connors, all the time. McEnroe, no. The worst thing McEnroe ever called somebody on the court was the Wimbledon umpire, who we called the pits of the world, until Australia in 1990. And I was there. I was researching hard courts. I was 10 feet away. And John cursed out a chair umpire and a supervisor at the same time. And you know what happened? He got disqualified, which he should have been. So that's not the right analogy to bring up. Is there a double standard, you know, for men and women? Yeah, there's no question. I mean, Elise Cornette was penalized for changing her shirt on the court during this U.S. Open. Now, the USTA turned around and said, okay, we made a mistake, because if you're going to let men change their shirts, you got to let women change their shirts. And the other thing, one other point, did you see the statement by Katrina Adams, the president of the USTA?
No.
It was all about, oh, Serena is such a leader, and she handled the defeat so well, and we're so proud of her and of Naomi, and it was such great tennis. Typical of tennis leadership to bury their head in the sand and not take on the issue. And what the USTA should have done was either said the umpire was wrong to give her the game penalty for yelling, or we stand by the umpire. She called him a thief. It doesn't matter what else was going on, whether she was male or female. She was wrong, and we're fining her. Now, they seem to take the umpire's side because they did fine her, but I think that was for the racket smash as much as anything, which is an automatic fine.
John Feinstein with us. John, why can't you have a hand signal from the crowd, from a coach?
That's my point, Jonathan. Why can't you?
Well, I mean,
because it's the rule. But
I know
why
it's
is it the
no,
rule?
Yeah, why
but
is that
I
the
think
rule,
he's
though?
Saying, why
saying.
Not change the rule? Yeah. The rule should have been changed 30 years ago. There's no, as I said, name me another sport where coaching's not allowed.
I thought.
Golf?
Yeah.
Well, golf, the caddy's allowed to coach.
Yeah. Right.
Caddy tells you, hit this club, don't hit this club. The putt's going to break left. The putt's going to break right. Calm down. You know, we're fine. That's coaching.
Absolutely.
John, I thought the post-match interview was very uncomfortable. I'm glad that Serena said something about, let's be positive, let's not boo, because Osaka
was
standing there.
She handled herself very well post-match.
I felt awful for Osaka when they went to her and she was in tears.
Yes.
Saying, I'm sorry that I upset the crowd so much by winning. And
yeah.
Everyone clearly wanted Serena to win, and now I feel bad about it.
Right.
It was just an awful moment for someone who is 20 years old and appeared to me to be younger than that in that moment.
This should have been, Chad, the greatest moment of her life. And she earned it. And she beat a woman who was her hero growing up. You know, it's a little bit like Djokovic yesterday matching Sampras, who was his hero growing up. And she didn't get to enjoy it. And it was partly Serena Williams' fault. It was partly the umpire's fault. And it was very much the crowd's fault. Because it's fine for the crowd to root for Serena. You know, she's the star. She's the hero. She tied Margaret Court's all-time record for Grand Slam victories. I get that. But give the kid credit for playing a brilliant match under those circumstances. And many in the crowd clearly didn't want to do that. They wanted to obsess about what had happened with Serena and the umpire, and they took it out on Osaka, which was totally unfair.
It's one thing that it seems like Williams did well there was to put her arm around her shoulder.
No, she did. No, yeah. As I said, Paul, I thought that once the match was over, she handled herself extremely well. I also saw tape of the post-match press conference. Tennis media is, I'm sorry, I was president of U.S. Tennis Writers once upon a time, but so soft. The second question to Serena, you know, somebody asked her about how she felt at that moment. That's fine. Second question went to Serena was, you know, how she felt as a mother. Okay, come on. You got to say, Serena, walk us through what happened out there. You know, gee whiz. But no, I thought Serena handled herself very well in defeat, which, by the way, has not always been the case in the past with her. For many years, she never gave the opponent credit for beating her. It was always that she had a bad day or she got a bad break. You remember the incident with Kim Clijsters where she threatened to put the ball a ball down a lineswoman's throat for calling her for a foot fault and handled that horribly. And had to apologize for her apology because she and her agent botched it so badly, the initial apology. But this, you know, Serena's older. She's more mature. She is a mother now. I thought she handled herself very well post-match.
Typically, the thought is among NFL players, you never go after someone for trying to get theirs in a contract. This seems to be some extenuating circumstances, though, with Le'Veon Bell sitting out after being franchised and his Steelers teammates' response to it. Then Le'Veon Bell yesterday sends out an emoji with someone peeping through an eyeglass as the Steelers were losing to the Browns without him there. What do you think about all this on both sides?
Well, you know, I don't think there are any winners in this, Chad, to be honest. I mean, clearly the Steelers need Le'Veon Bell. As you said, they go into Cleveland and were lucky to get out with a tie. His backup had a key fumble late in the game, and they're not the same team without him. The flip side is the rules say that the team can franchise him, and they franchised him for $14.5 million. And I just want to say for the record, I would work for that. But the point being that he's losing money every week he doesn't play, and he's probably hurting himself as a free agent next spring, because teams are going to, you know, teams are going to look at him and say he's really talented and he's 20. They're also going to look at him and say, how big a headache is this guy? And how much of a problem might he potentially be in the locker room? He'll have his money, but will something else come up? You know, it's a little like Dez Bryant in that sense. So this to me is a lose-lose. The Steelers are losing because they need him on the field, and he's losing by not being on the field. And the thing about the teammates, Chad, you're absolutely right what you say, but the minute he walks back into the locker room and the other guys realize, oh, he's back, we need him, everything will be fine.
John, looking at the college football game Saturday night that everyone was watching, A&M and Clemson, I thought it was a terrific game. I still think the rule where the fumble that goes through the end zone, that goes the other team and goes the 20, is way too punitive. And I also thought that we talked a lot about NFL officials today after that Titans-Dolphins game. I thought the officials screwed it up. I thought it was pretty clear that the ball went left of the pylon when it was fumbled and should have been Texas A&M ball there. Now, they eventually went down and scored and didn't get the two-point conversion after that. But
right.
Sad to see sort of a controversial moment in a game that was really good.
Yeah, certainly a good start in a sense for Jimbo Fisher to play Clemson that competitively. It was a home game, but you know, if I'm a Texas A&M fan, I feel pretty good about the money they shelled out for Jimbo Fisher, at least at this moment. I don't know about the touchback rule, Chad. What would be your alternative? Because I think that if you fumble on the goal line, there should be some kind of fairly punitive penalty, because it's just dumb to fumble on the goal line, to be honest with you. Now, if the ball goes out of bounds before it crosses the goal line, obviously the ball is down there. But if it goes through the end zone, what would you do as an alternative? I'm not saying I necessarily disagree with you, but I'd like to know your alternative.
I just think that there should be a rule where you can't fumble through the end zone. You can't fumble forward into the end zone. If that was the rule, the ball is simply down where it's spotted.
If you fumble and nobody recovers, you just put the ball down where the guy lost possession.
Yes. If it's going out of bounds or into the end zone, you just get it back where. Now, the flip side of that is you're going to have guys doing all sorts of crazy things trying to get the ball into the end zone on fourth down plays,
right,
where they wouldn't otherwise do that because there's no risk of them.
That's right.
I'm at breakfast yesterday, this topic came up, John, and I threw out, why not in a situation, you're really penalizing the offense here dramatically. You're taking mm-hmm. 6 points away, 7 points away.
Potentially, right.
What if they fumble through the end zone? What if the offense gets the ball in the 20? That way you're giving basically.
I thought you were going to say the 10, and I was going to say, okay.
You move it back to the 20.
Yeah.
Loss of down, however you want to penalize the offense
right.
for that moment.
And the chances are you're not going to score, but you'll still get a chance to kick a field goal.
That's right. You're getting 3 points instead of
that
six.
That might be a good compromise.
And then if you make a run.
See Chad's point.
If you make a run from, you know, the 50 and you fumble through the end zone, you go back
right.
to the original line of scrimmage.
Right.
I mean, if you're inside the 20 and you fumble, the ball goes to the 20.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that might be a good idea, because as you said, that if you make it where there's really no penalty and you just put the ball down where it's fumbled, then why not, you know, fling the ball toward the end zone,
because
you've got nothing to lose if the ball doesn't cross the goal line before you lose it.
This is where I'm old school and I say leave it the way it is, because it's always been that way, and just for consistency's sake, which isn't necessarily
well, but
the way
if
I change
the rule, Paul, it would be consistent.
No, but I want it to be consistent that if so and so fumbled in the playoffs in 1990, and it
yeah, but that rule isn't keeping like
yeah,
way,
but rules have been changed throughout history in all sports, Paul.
The argument for keeping rules the same are for halls of fame.
You want to bring back leather helmets while you're at it?
No.
Paul also likes ties in the NFL. He's a big fan of ties.
I have no problem with the tie in the NFL.
You and Donovan McNabb.
I knew it was possible. I'll say that. Hey, we've been talking this morning. And I think this is a really underplayed storyline. Sam Rosen and Chris Carter had the Titans game on Fox. By all accounts, they were horrible with mispronunciations and not knowing who was who. This, to me, the bad broadcast crews at the bottom of the list for the networks who cover multiple games, to me, have always had a free pass in that it's NFL football and people are going to watch. Well, now we're looking for reasons people are turning away. And I think this is one of the reasons. Why would I, in the day of the best television in the history of the world, turn on a game, listen to a guy, not know anybody on my team and can't pronounce their name, and stick with it? Why do Fox and CBS not make strides to have better crews on these games?
I'm surprised to hear that about Sam Rosen.
He's a very good hockey guy.
Yeah, he's great on hockey, and I think he's a pro. I've always thought of him as a pro. I haven't heard Chris Carter do enough games to really comment on
him. I think that was his first one.
Well, okay, so that might be a partial explanation if he was bad, why he was bad, but you're right. I mean, there are definitely guys who are doing network television because of who they were, or in some cases because of who they know. I've done enough TV through the years in different contexts than this, but to know that a lot of the time guys get on the air because of who they know, who they've sucked up to, who their agent knows. A lot of it has to do with agents having contact. But the other thing is, and this I saw firsthand, a lot of times when someone who's in charge of a network, the person who's making the decisions on who's going to get the on-air jobs, a lot of times they'll hire somebody, and that person is clearly a mistake. But if they get rid of the person, what are they saying? I made a mistake. I screwed it up. And people in charge have trouble saying that. You know, saying that Chris Carter's a disaster, if he is a disaster long term. It's why guys often survive in jobs for a long time when they're clearly not ever good at it, or might have once been good at it but weren't good at it later. Phil Simms, I thought when he first was on the air doing color, I thought he was good. But I don't know if he lost interest or whatever happened. But the last couple of years, he was a bad listen. And it took CBS about 5 years and Tony Romo being available to finally get him out of the booth. And even then, they didn't fire him. They just put him in the studio. And I'm not picking on Phil Simms. I happen to like the guy. But this happens a lot where network executives don't want to admit they've made a mistake.
John Feinstein with us every Monday. John, always appreciate it. We'll do it again next week.
I will look forward to it, guys. And can I say one thing before I go?
Of course.
Tomorrow's 9/11. It would be great if we all tried to remember how we felt after 9/11 and understanding the difference between an enemy and an opponent in sports. Because there was a period there after 9/11 where I think we understood it in a way we never had. And it'd be great if we could get back to doing that and not trying to act as if a team we don't like or an individual we don't like is an enemy.
Well said, John.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you next week.